This is
Sheffield Indie Media
on Sheffield Live
106.6 FM on the web at sheffield.indiemedia.org.uk.
Right, good evening. It's Bill here on the Sheffield Indie Media show on Sheffield Live 106.6 FM on Tuesday, the 29th of July. This is our last show ever, and we're doing a two-hour extravaganza. The weather here, just for the record, and just because I'm extemporising, I like that word, weather here in Sheffield is rather grey and miserable, even though it's July. Pretty grim, really. If you're watching on the internet, you can see on the webcam that's pointed out of the window that it's a rainy day here. Anyway, I'm going to try and introduce what we hope to achieve tonight. We're going to have a little bit of music, because we're on for a two-hour special, and we'll play a few tunes, four, five, six tunes, something like that. We may have some poems from the Buddhist punk, who can't join us this week again, because he had sprained his ankle. So I made this joke last week, and I'll make it again. Bad karma all round, Buddhist punk. We're going to have Steve interviewing a guy called Alan about cob building, which is an environmentally friendly way of doing housing. Very cheap as well, very cost effective. Steve's also going to interview Sophie, who was in the studio last week, about free parties. Maybe the Trolley Collective will be down as well. Lucy is going to be talking to, hopefully at 6:15 by phone. This is going to be our first ever phone interview. She's going to be talking to a guy called Paul from Sheffield CND, who has news of a campaign on August the 6th to commemorate the Hiroshima bombings. Lucy will also speak to Max from Uncaged, a campaign group against vivisection, and they recently won a legal case against animal testing. Sounds very interesting. We're going to have Lucy again, hopefully, speaking to Kathleen from Holistic Fraternity, and they are trying to protect ancient woodlands somewhere near Rotherham. I'll be speaking to Chris about... Chris is an active member of Sheffield's open source software community, and I'll be talking to him about Linux and open source software. And we showed a film on Saturday in Sheffield called Revolution OS, which is about Linux and free software. We're going to have Christina talking to Ali, an Iranian exile, about his experiences. So we've got quite a full show, actually. We're going to be making it up to some extent as we go along. So without further ado, to give me a bit of time and work out what we're going to do next, I'm going to play the second part of an interview with Nick and Helen, which I attempted to play last week, but I played the first one again. So we like the interview so much that this is the third time Nick and Helen have been on the air. And this is an interview with Nick and Helen, two local activists who've been to Genoa and to Evian. And it's a great interview. It was recorded outside in a nice sunny Sheffield afternoon, or morning actually it was, with the birds tweeting in the background. So Nick and Helen, and it's Paul T who is interviewing Nick and Helen.
The second day on the Saturday was a day of planning for what was going to be the major day of action on the Sunday. And previously publicised over the internet was a basic framework for how they thought we could attempt to shut down the G8. Basically, there was no access to Evian. They'd completely sealed that small town. There was three routes into Evian for all the delegates and the support staff and translators, etc. One was Lausanne, where Trolley D went to try and shut down the port there, where they were crossing across the lake. Second, similarly with Geneva, where a lot of the delegates were staying, they were going to try and immobilise Geneva. The third aspect of this international cross-boundary plan was in France, and all the traffic of the delegates and the administration and support staff couldn't apparently go across the lake. So there was the turnpike roads ran through France up to Evian, which was rumoured where a lot of the translators were going to travel. So that was the third piece in the jigsaw to shut down those roads. So that was the plan of the Vargues village. That was going to be its role in the blockade day. So on Sunday, we had to get up about 3 o'clock in the morning, walk about 6 kilometres. How many people would you say there was? Several hundred?
I thought it was 2,000.
Right, can't remember. It's all...
Don't count it.
Yeah, I was too busy marching. So basically, we got to as far up the road as we could in the early morning, and we nearly made it to our destination where three roads met, which was going to be the turnpike, which was going to close all three roads. Unfortunately, the police had put a line across the road about a kilometre from our destination. So basically, we got into action, set up our barricade, and tried to hold the road. And we did so for 7 hours in the end. We were met with... The police didn't move up to our front line. It was 7 hours of containment of them continuously tear gassing us and concussion grenades, trying to sort of more so push us back. But in the heat and a long day, we held out in quite difficult circumstances. And we also realised that we hadn't blocked the other two smaller roads, so we had to send off groups to go and block the two minor roads. One was which was over some fields to a local village. And again, a small group there were bombarded with tear gas and continuously tried to be repelled, but we held. And finally, by lunchtime, the news came through that the blockades in Lausanne and Geneva had fallen, but all three had held sufficiently long to delay the particularly the translators getting to the morning meetings, and they had to be delayed. I mean, we were acting on information that we sort of received on the day, so how much we know what was the truth in other cities, we don't really know, but based on the information we got that day, we seen that across France and Switzerland, the activists had held out for a short time.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion at the barricades. People had formed themselves into affinity groups. Usually some affinity groups could just be 7 people, some affinity groups were 200. And delegates of those groups met and discussed tactics throughout the day, where we should hold, what our actions should be, and
continuously revising the situation and where we wanted to be.
Absolutely. And also discussion of tactics and strategy, realising there were other smaller roads that we heard rumours of delegates getting through. Villagers were giving us information. And I think that was an important part of the action. The villagers were, and we've seen this at the G8 demonstrations in Genoa, despite what the media say, the locals are very supportive of what we do and are usually in agreement. And the village next to the barricades that we held were very supportive, giving us tea, water, allowing us to use their toilets. And, you know, that's another inspiring aspect.
Providing logs for our fires.
For the burning barricades.
Burning barricades.
So it was actually a static barricade. The police seemed happy to hold us there, but I didn't think they were aware that we would realise that there were other roads, the other two roads, so I think they were a bit annoyed that we'd managed to block them as well. But, I mean, we did actually stand through 7 hours of constant. It was actually, there wasn't a lull in the whole 7 hours. If we weren't getting hit by tear gas, we were getting hit by concussion grenades. And it was inspiring to see people's responses to this attack. There were a lot of people that hadn't been to something like this before, and a lot of them were panicky and getting worried, but people that had been on the receiving end of tear gas, their response inspired a lot of people to maintain the barricade. So,
and I think they realised that the fear of tear gas and concussion grenades isn't so great. People there were supporting them, telling them to sort of how to deal with the tear gas. They'd been briefed quite a bit beforehand, so had plenty of water. We had support groups that had come up in a bus behind us, ferrying water in shopping trolleys to the front. And because we're in the open space, you could sort of move out of the tear gas. So I think a great thing was people overcoming that barrier, that fear of what happens to you in tear gas, and everybody sort of settled down and people began to sort of get braver. You could see them getting brave and going up and throwing the tear gas back, and you know, they'd overcome that fear. And a great part of it was the samba band that was there, and a lot of people at first were hesitant to move up to the barricade where the front line of the tear gas. But the samba band really inspired people and kept us together. Once they moved up front, continuously drumming through the tear gas, people felt brave enough, I think, to follow them. And I think they were the stars. They really held people together, particularly people for whose it was their first experience and quite a daunting one.
Okay, I'm going to hopefully wrap up now. I asked the same question to Trolley last week. What have you brought back from Evian? What has this experience meant to you?
I think essentially I've touched on it a few times. It's just the inspiration that I've got from the response from people that wouldn't be naturally classified as activists, anti-capitalist activists, and that's predominantly the local people. The villagers that were so helpful on the Sunday with the main action, and particularly, I think, importantly, the Monday, when we didn't actually realise demonstrations were banned in Geneva, and we went and did an action, and we were boxed in by the police, and the locals came out to help us, the Genevan locals, and they took on the police as well. They were trying to break us free, they were protesting against police actions. I think that is something essentially that I've brought back, is just that people are willing to open up to our message, their understanding of what we're about to an extent, and also, you know, they're not dulled or blinded by the media, the blinding media message that the G8 wish to push through, and that's, you know, that is the main inspiring thing, that they have taken up action against the state and against the G8 themselves, and I think that is something that I've brought back. It's just very inspiring.
I mean, I would echo that completely. Just the sense of the connectivity it gives you. I mean, quite often you think you're alone in your own community battling against issues that just seem so enormous, and it's just so invigorating and re-inspires you to see so many people who connect with you. And as Nick said, that the resistance goes wider than the people who are immediately around you. Those who are not necessarily active in every day are supporting our agenda and reflecting that in the warmth, just everything from cheering us as we go past to giving us hugs to feeding us to everything, and being able to sort of bring that enthusiasm back is just great. And of course, making linkages with other activists and sharing stories and experience is always great fun and worth going for that alone.
Nick, Helen, thanks very much for your time.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Right, that was an interview with Nick and Helen of Sheffield Indie Media, two local activists who were at the Genoa and Evian actions, interviewed by Paul. That was the second part of a two-part interview. The first part we inadvertently played twice, but there you go, it's a good interview. I've just realised that I haven't done any shout-outs to anyone, so we might have Philippe listening from Montreal via the internet. A shout out to Anarcho Babe and Space Bunny, who might be listening or might be attending a film tonight in Edinburgh. There's the London IMC radio crew, there's Sean, and I can't remember all the rest of the names. Somebody, Chris Corrupt Youth, I think his email address is. Dave at Planet something or other, can't remember. But anyway, big shout out to everybody out there. I've got also some material that was recorded by Anarcho Babe from Scotland IMC. Some very interesting interviews there's an interview with Mark Thomas, an interview with a guy called Simon, who was arrested on the 17th of July at an anti-war demonstration for carrying a placard, I believe, a flag, which was emblazoned with a phrase which was deemed to be derogatory to President Bush and an arrestable offence. So very interesting stuff there. We're hoping very soon to get a telephone interview with Paul from Sheffield CND, who's going to talk about commemoration of the Hiroshima bombings, and that will be in Sheffield on August the 6th. For now, we're going to go into some music, which is 537 Cuba by the Orishas.
Pega y cuando llega no despega, pega, pega lo que puso el ruso en el discurso que con Bay segundo puso entre tus secas.
Ahora la distancia queda.
Si de mi lengua estoy viviendo y calmando mi fiel tristeza, ¿de qué forma quieres tú que yo detenga la sangre de amor y patria que me corre por las venas? Generaciones vieja y nueva, de corazón, sangre y pulmón.
Allá lejos, donde el sol calienta más, olvidé mi corazón.
De ella ni lo intentes, todo el tiempo está en mi mente, la tengo presente, ¿entiendes? Me habla el corazón que no me miente, hermano, flotando ando, pasando la mano, mano sobre el mapa de este mundo, y desde lo profundo de mi corazón siento nostalgia, una extraña sensación como añoranza, de esta distancia que se interpone, que regresaré bien se supone, y eso me pone el hombre más feliz por un segundo, ya lo cantó con Pai Segundo, y yo de nuevo escucho el quejo de mi gente chico, bien te lo explico, cubano 100% prototipo.
Me arrancaré el corazón, y esperaré mi regreso, para sacarlo otra vez.
Por de buena vista Miramar a la mar, la victoria Habana Vieja, barrio nuevo Bejucal. ¿Dónde estás tú, mi rampa? El sol que canta, la catedral, el Capitolio se levanta en el oído de estas voces. 23 y 12, velado, paseo del Prado, tus leones lado a lado forman parte de mis tradiciones, mis emociones. Eres tú, mi Cuba, como tú, ninguna. Cabio, si le soy Yoruba, que no quede duda que si lloro es porque le extraño no ver mi malecón a mis amigos de mi zona, los que nacieron conmigo, los que jugaron conmigo. Recordarlos sin tenerlos me hace daño. Año tras año sueño con volver a ver esos amigos que añoraba. Color de la campiña cuando llueve, el morro, el cañonazo de las nueve. El que te quiere nunca muere, no, jamás, jamás.
Vengo de donde hay un río, tabaco y caña, veral, donde el sudor del guajiro hacia la tierra soñar. Vengo de donde hay un río, tabaco y caña, veral, donde el sudor del guajiro hacia la tierra soñar. Vengo de donde hay un río, tabaco y caña, veral, donde el sudor del guajiro hacia la tierra.
Right, that was the Orishas with 537 Cuba. I had the fortune to see them live at the Royal Festival Hall last year. Very good band. Now I'm going to hand over to Lucy, who is talking to Paul from Sheffield C&D, who is actually live in the studio, and it's a guy called Max from Uncaged that we're hoping to get on the phone. But over to you, Lucy and Paul.
Hi. Okay then, Paul. Sheffield C&D, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. Tell me what it is you stand for.
Sheffield CND is part of the National CND, and as implicit within the title of the organisation, it's about saying that nuclear weapons are something which are an obscenity, should never be used, and it's something that we need to get rid of, and we need to start with Britain as being one of the biggest holders of nuclear weapons in the world and not wait for other people first.
Okay, and your campaigning and actions, what, have you done any recently that you want to talk about?
Yeah, there's a variety of campaigns taking place up and down the country which CND are involved in, from Menwith Hill to Fylingdale through to campaigns in Scotland and the upgrading of nuclear missiles down in the south and so on. And CND has been very much involved in those. But also CND is trying to raise the profile of some of the changes that have taken place, particularly in US missile defence strategies around issues like Star Wars, and also about the way the United States is now seriously considering using nuclear weapons. And what CND has been really trying to get across to people is that nuclear weapons aren't just something which were used in the past, never to be used again. It's unfortunately looking increasingly likely that they're going to be used as the United States considers new ways of developing new types of nuclear missiles. So we're saying to people, nuclear weapons are something now which we should be campaigning against.
And this isn't just a global issue or a national issue. This can be brought right locally because, as some people may well know, that the University of Sheffield actually has involvement with a corporation called Boeing, which I believe is a contractor for national missile defence. Would you like? Do you know?
Yeah, well, it's a bit difficult to talk about, really, because the university is very, very cagey about its connections, and some very good work's being done on that by people in CND in Sheffield. But actually getting the university to admit the connections is very, very difficult. But what we do know is that clearly the United States is talking about developing a so-called SHIELD, which they're calling missile defence. We're referring to it as US National Missile Defence, because effectively what that will mean is that the US will have a shield which protects them from being attacked. But it will then mean that their sword is then much more effective because nobody can strike them. And really what will happen is they will be able to attack their enemies with impunity. At the moment, they're arguing that it's about protecting the United States from so-called rogue states like North Korea. But actually, when you read the real documentation and look at the real debates that are taking place in the sort of elite in the United States, their real target is Russia, but particularly later on China. And what is worrying is that there are serious people in the United States preparing for war with China in the next 2 to 3 decades or so, and the whole strategy around national missile defence fits into that. But Britain's got a particular role because of Fylingdale and Wentworth Hill, and we've also got a particular role because our Secretary of State for Defence, Jeff Hoon, recently agreed to upgrading of those bases with a bogus consultation process which ignored any basic democratic rights of the people in this country. So we're campaigning against that to highlight that bogus consultation progress and to say that Menwith Hill and Fylingdale should be closed down and should not be used as a means by which the United States can produce this so-called defence shield so they can attack other countries with impunity.
Ah, right. Thanks for that. That's quite important information that I think people should need to hear. I brought you in today to talk about an action that you're going to be doing on the 6th of August to commemorate the victims of Hiroshima. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what's going to be going on in Sheffield?
Yeah, I think one of the things that happens every year is that people about that time do get reminded of the events that took place in Hiroshima and Nagasaki when tens of thousands of innocent people were killed by the US dropping atomic weapons on their cities. And what we're trying to do this year is again make sure that people are reminded of those horrific events. And in the Peace Gardens next to the Town Hall on Wednesday 6th of August between 10 and 4 there will be a number of events and so on happening during that day. There'll be a stall leafleting from 10 a.m. to midday. The Mayor of Sheffield will also take part in that day. There's going to be an interfaith service after the Mayor's speech, and also there will be something that will appear to children to try and educate them about these events in the past. There's going to be some crane folding in Japanese style, and there'll be facilities and instructions for children to do that. And I think the message of the day is that nuclear weapons have been used before. We don't want them to be used again. And unfortunately, we're living in times now in the 21st century where we were promised peace, but it's looking like that nuclear weapons aren't off the agenda at all, and people are seriously talking about creating nuclear weapons that they can use. We've had that once. We don't want it to happen again.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Paul, for coming in to talk to us about Sheffield CND. If you want to get involved and come down and meet them, they meet at the Quaker Meeting House at 7 p.m. every third Monday of the month. Okay, now we're going to go back to Will.
Okay, thank you, Paul. That was very interesting indeed. Right, hopefully next, if I'm waving furiously at Steve, he's talking to a very interesting chap called Alan about environmental housing, or earth building, also known as cob building apparently, and all that kind of scene that's happening in Sheffield. So over to Steve with Alan.
Right, hi everybody. I'm going to talk to Alan. Alan is from Earthed, which is a community arts group that runs sustainable building workshops, and their aim is to empower people to express their own creativity and produce practical structures and environments. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Steve. Hi.
Right, so do you want to tell us first what exactly cob building is?
Cob building is a ye old English term for an ancient version of earth building that's used in this country for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And what it is basically, it's a mixture of earth, sand, and straw, and you mix the materials together to form lumps, which are the cobs, and then you use the cobs to build walls with, or and you can sculpt the building in the same way you would sculpt a pot. So it's very similar to that. It's not fired, it's just left to dry, and it becomes like a kind of soft version of concrete.
So is that the same as Wattle and Daub, the old buildings that used to be used in London and elsewhere?
No, this is something that a lot of people get confused with. Basically, Wattle and Daub is an old-fashioned method of building which uses a timber frame. And if you go to places like York or Chester, you'll see a lot of Wattle and Daub buildings, which are basically timber frame, and that's infilled with Wattle and Daub, which is a structure a bit like the ancient equivalent of plasterboard, which where the wattle is woven willow, and the daub is a kind of horsehair and earth plaster, which is daubed on top of the willow frame to make a kind of partition. But that's just to fill in the gaps in a timber frame building. So it's very different from cob, where the majority of the building material is actually earth itself.
So the main the structural strength is in the walls itself, not in anything else.
Yeah, that's right. And the advantage are. One of the advantages of that is the fact that you don't have to use much timber. So unlike a timber frame building, which uses sort of quite a few mature oak trees, a cob building will use hardly anything apart from the roof and the floor structure.
So what other advantages are there of cob building?
It's apart from being environmentally friendly, it's also very, very cheap to build with, and it's easy to learn. It's something that most people can pick up in a couple of weeks. If that, you can probably pick it up in a weekend, the basics of it.
Okay, and so environmentally, I mean, there's all different sorts of other kinds of methods for building these days. There's sort of straw bale housing, there's rammed earth and other kinds. What advantages are there of cob building? Why did you choose cob building as something to sort of take up and learn?
Cob building's been proven all over the world. Some of the oldest vaults and arches still in existence are made from cob, and they're in Iraq and in Iran. I mean, parts of the oldest parts of the Great Wall of China are made with cob. So it's a well-proven building technique, unlike some of the others, such as straw bale. And the oldest straw bale structure that I know about is just over 120 years old, I think. So, and there's not the supportive evidence to see the longevity of a lot of straw bale structures. And also, it lends itself to sculptural form, so you can actually sculpt your environment around you instead of actually building a square structure and then trying to fit your activities into the space.
So you don't need a degree in planning or architecture to build something like this then, or design it even?
No, I mean, one of the reasons I got so interested in it with my partner Annabelle is that it's such an easy technique to learn. Anyone can do it. you don't have to have any kind of qualification or any experience in building to be able to pick up the basics of cob building. And that's what we've started to do. We're teaching people how to do it for themselves so that they can come away and actually build structures of their own or make a change to their own environment, even if it's in a small way in the garden or in just a room of the of their existing house.
Yeah, I was just going to talk about what you can actually build. I know you've built a lovely dragon bench cum oven at Healy City Farm with you and Annabelle and a few other people who are learning the techniques. But what sort of size can cob buildings go up to?
Well, if there's any people out there listening to the radio from Yemen, and I know there's a big Yemeni community in Sheffield, they'll know that cob buildings can be huge. There's some there's a city in an area called Shibam in South Yemen where cob buildings are 13, 14 stories high. So you can build huge structures with this material. It's extremely strong. Buildings there have lasted since the 15th century and people are still adding to it. There's a whole city there that's made of cob, and there's a whole area where cob buildings still the preferred method of building.
And it's particularly good insulation, I presume, both from the hot and the cold. Is that right?
It's not brilliant in the cold. What it does act as is a thermal battery. So the best thing about cob is that its thermal qualities in terms of retaining heat. So if you situate the building correctly in terms of using passive solar energy, you can actually retain the warmth of the sun and it'll slowly release it overnight. So it's very good for desert climates. It's very good for temperate places like Britain as well, where there are, I think there's 450,000 cob buildings down in Devon and Cornwall around the southwest of England. And if you go down there on holiday and have a look at some of the older buildings, particularly with thick whitewashed walls, thatched roofs, go and have a close look at them and you'll probably find that most of those are made of cob.
So why just in that particular area then? Why are there not more cob building going on elsewhere in this country?
Well, in the rest of the country, cob's been kind of forgotten about, mainly because of the Industrial Revolution and the desire to build regimented structures for the workforce in industrial areas like Sheffield, where a lot of workers' houses had to be built very quickly. And as a result, you see for yourself lines of housing, houses that are all the same. And there's very few people in this sort of area who built houses for themselves. So, but the precedent has been set in the southwest, where a chap called Kevin McCabe has just recently completed a huge new cob house that's worth about 750,000, and that's just built with local earth.
Right, so that sounds pretty expensive, but you were saying earlier that cob building can be extremely cheap. I mean, how much money would it cost to build a cob house, and how does it compare to the sort of building of more standard housing structures?
Well, one of the most inspiring things from my point of view was visiting and staying in a cob house in Oregon in America when we were learning the cob building techniques, and that house was built for $500. So it's quite possible to build a very, very cheap house. I mean, the majority of houses in Devon and Cornwall that are still around that are 200, 300 years old will have been built by peasants for virtually nothing. Even if you look at the walls, modern cob buildings used quite a lot of straw, but in those days the straw was quite an expensive commodity, so they didn't even bother using much of that. So it must have cost, peanuts really, in relative terms.
Right, and it's not difficult to learn. How if someone wants to learn to build with cob, how would they go about doing that?
Well, they can come on one of our workshops. They're free, and you can find out about them through contacting myself or Annabelle at earthworld@hotmail.com. Or you could get onto the internet, and if you put search in for earth building, it'll come up with a variety of people, mainly in the UK, Denmark, Germany, and America, who are running cob building courses. There's some also in Devon and Cornwall, if you're interested in going down there and spending a week or so, or just a weekend, and learning the basic techniques. But it's very easy to pick up. It's the kind of thing you could do over a weekend. You can pick up the basics of it.
Right, okay. I should just say that's Earthed World. That's E-A-R-T-H-E-D world at hotmail.com, just in case you didn't hear that. And what is Earthed doing at the moment then? You're travelling around Britain, is that right?
Yeah. We're running a touring project, and we're building 7 different structures for community composting network sites around the country, which are in permaculture gardens, in various different places. We've just completed a little meeting space for people up in a Crossway Centre, which is for people with learning difficulties, up in Leyland. And our next project, which we've just started, is in Apedale Country Park in Newcastle-under-Lyme, down in Stoke. So if anyone wants to come along to the workshop, which is next weekend, you can get details off me through the email address that we've given.
Okay, I think that's about it. Is there anything else you want to say about that, Alan, before we go? Or
No.
That's it.
Just come along if you fancy coming along and having a go.
Okay.
You're quite welcome.
Great, thanks very much. Back over to Bill.
Okay, it's me again. That was a very interesting interview with Alan, who was talking about the environmental earth-building project in Sheffield and elsewhere. We've got an interview through the power of technology by phone with Max from Uncaged, which is a campaign group against vivisection, and they recently won a legal case against animal testing. Let's see if we can hear anything.
Hello, I'm here.
That's Max. Okay, then I've got Lucy here, who will speak to you about your interview. Okay, cheers.
Cheers.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, hello. Okay, Uncaged, a local campaign group.
That's right, yes. We're actually a national anti-vivisection organisation, but it is based in Sheffield and was founded by Angela and Lynn, who are two Sheffield residents, almost 10 years ago now. And we campaign against animal experiments. One of our major campaigns is a boycott of Procter & Gamble campaign. Procter & Gamble make products like Ariel, Smooth Delights, and IM's Pet Food, and they conduct tests on animals for new products and new chemical ingredients. And obviously we campaign across the board against all animal experiments. We have recently won a landmark victory in what we call the Diaries of Despair campaign.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about the Diaries of Despair? What is this?
Yes, yeah, certainly. Basically, a bit over 2 years ago, we got leaked a huge cache of confidential documents about pig-to-primate transplant experiments, or DNA transplantation experiments, that were conducted by a company called Imitran, owned by a large company called Novartis, that took place at the notorious animal testing laboratory, Huntington Life Sciences. And they basically revealed that it was one of the most severe and horrific programs of animal experiments ever seen in the UK. And the documents basically provided a unique insight into these particular experiments and the vivisection industry in general in the UK. And also, perhaps more pertinently, the government and the Home Office's collusion with the vivisection industry in downplaying the severity of these animal experiments and of basically not enforcing any of its own regulations about breaching the law or such like. And after we published these documents, after my colleague Dan Lyons wrote a very long report into them, Imitran, the company, obtained an injunction against us publishing these documents, which it basically took us 2 years fighting against pretty high-powered lawyers, some of the ones which also represented Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones in their recent case. And after about 2 years, we won a landmark victory on the public interest terms, and basically that these documents in the report were recognised as being very much in the public interest, that the public and the media and people engaged in the debate about animal experiments and, you know, have the right to know what really happens. The documents and the report really blow the lid off the government and the industry lies about a tightly regulated system in the UK.
It's a brilliant example of a successful fight for freedom of information, if I've ever heard one.
Yes, absolutely. It was very much a David and Goliath battle, and my colleague Dan had to represent himself without any legal aid for the vast majority of the case. And we eventually won the right to publish the information.
I mean, this attempt to suppress this information kind of reveals that the content of this report must have been fairly scandalous. Can you explain a little bit more about how horrific these cases are?
I can, yes. Basically, one of the most horrific sections of the documents were reports written by the lab technicians detailing exactly what was happening to the baboons and monkeys that were having genetically modified pigs' hearts and kidneys implanted into the necks of these monkeys. I could read you out a verbatim quote from what's written about baboon W201N. It says, in short, swelling in the neck is still considerable. Some seepage of blood from the wound, lying on the cage floor, uncoordinated limb spasms, and then sacrificed. And the documents also reveal, lots of breaches of regulations by the people doing the experiments, which the Home Office recognised in letters, calling their attitude to the regulations cavalier. And yet, failed to enforce any of these regulations or issue more than simply a slap on the wrist. Other documents detail the Home Office basically colluding with Imitran in order to downgrade the severity banding of these experiments, which to anybody's eye are severe. They caused extreme pain and death to hundreds of primates. Many of which were caught and shipped over from the wild, and yet the government colluded with Imitran to downgrade them to merely a moderate severity banding, which is clearly nonsense.
Yeah, this is quite extreme stuff, and if anybody out there listening is personally horrified or disgusted by what the government's allowing or any of the vivisection industries work, how exactly would they get involved?
The best thing to do would be to contact Uncaged on Sheffield 272-2220. We have a day of action, Dies of Despair day of action, coming up on the 20th of September this year, which will be the third anniversary of the original publication of the documents and the report. And basically there'll be actions, protests, information stalls and letter writing blitzes, things like this taking place all over the UK. We haven't got confirmed exactly what we'll be doing in Sheffield yet, but we'll probably have a protest of some sort, maybe at David Blunkett's offices, who is now the Home Office Minister, the Home Secretary, and it's sort of his responsibility for this area. We've learnt from our experience that one of the best ways for ordinary people to get involved, as well as contacting us for more information, is simply to visit their MP. Obviously, MPs are the people in power. We're calling for an independent judicial inquiry into the behaviour of the Home Office. We've got 94 MPs who've signed an early day motion calling for such an inquiry, and basically if everybody went and visited their local MP and impressed upon them the need for such an inquiry, that would be a great way of putting pressure on the government and on the Home Office in order to get such an inquiry.
Okay, well, it's brilliant stuff you're doing there, and thank you for phoning in and talking to us. It's
no worries, thank you.
Over to Bill then.
Okay, thank you, Lucy, and thank you, Max, from Uncaged, the campaign group against vivisection. Just for a bit of a break now, we'll have a bit of music from Susanna Bacca. This tune is called... My Spanish should be better than this. I've been studying it for 3 years. I don't know. Tres de Mayo. Anyway, something like that. 13 de Mayo. And it's a tune by originally by Caetano Veloso. And reading the sleeve notes, it tells a story that is common to all people. When there's something to celebrate, black people have something that is without time, place, language, belonging. It is part of everybody. It is a thread that joins the body with music.
Plaza del mercado, los negros celebraban, tal vez aún lo hacen. Fin de la esclavitud, fin de la esclavitud, fin de la esclavitud. Día 13 de mayo en Santo Amaro. La plaza del mercado, los pletos celebraban, tal vez aún lo hacen. Fin de la esclavitud, fin de la esclavitud, fin de la esclavitud.
Right, and there was Susanna Bacca there, singing about the end of slavery. And we're going to continue now with Ali. We've got a very special guest here today with us. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Ali. And Ali's from Iran, and we're just going to have a little chat about the political situation and a few things about Iran, which apparently is on the blacklist of the US and on the axis of evil. And all that lovely rhetoric that they like using. So yeah, hello Ali. You've been in the UK for quite a few years, but you also go back to Iran from what I know, so you've got a kind of insider-outsider kind of place. So first of all, I think we'll just ask you about, yeah, what's the current political situation right now? Just set a bit of context, as a lot of our listeners might not know.
The current situation is the long battle between reformists and conservatives, which has been going on for a quite while. It seems it's part of the Islamic Republic's history. It's just faction battles. And recently, very recently, loads of reporters been arrested and... this is part of the reformists which came to power in 1997 with landslide victory of President Khatami took over, and it seems this is the very current situation. It is just continuation of that battle in order to reform Islamic Republic to something which is more accepted in international community. It's ironic that in 1997, in this country, Tony Blair took power, or Labour power, and if you compare how much they achieved in Iran, it's probably not far to say how much they've achieved in UK by New Labour. I think probably that will give to someone who's in England a better idea what reformists have achieved in Iran.
So in other words, they're quite near the conservative... side, you'd say, or the reformists, or
yes, there are some achievements. Like possibly there are more freedom in a sense; they can write a little bit more than prior to 1997. But in ordinary daily life, I do not think people have gained any particular. Feel that they could be happy or fulfilled with the situation. It is similar like UK. If somebody asks someone who's living in UK what has changed since 1997, it is very difficult to pinpoint on a particular area to say this is better than conservatives. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, I do not think reformists have achieved anything substantial in Iran.
As far as you mean personal liberties as well and so on, continue or in...
Yes, personal liberties are better. Then again, it wasn't just to reformists. It was mostly women's struggle, and Islamic Republic could not do anything with them. They've achieved in that respect a little bit expressing themselves, but nothing substantial, I don't think.
Right, and I mean, recently on the news we saw some, well, let's say some terrible pictures from Iranian women setting themselves on fire and so on. Where do they fit in the whole picture, for example? I think are they part of the Mujahideen, I think?
Yes, it was a protest against arresting their leaders. Some of their leaders in France been arrested. I do not have information details, but I think it's part of the deal which American did in Iraq. Mujahideen is one of the oppositions which have been opposing the Iranian government for two decades. They were based in Iraq, and they did carry out some armed struggle against the Iranian government. But with the situation changing in Iraq, their situation changed. Although they are considered by Americans' government as a terrorist groups, nonetheless, looks like Americans made a deal or in the process of making some deals. So it is very difficult to say, but I think probably French government in competition with Americans probably did arrest some of their leaders. However, these groups are Islamic groups, even though they claim they might have a better version of the Islamic government, but they are sectarian groups, and it is sad to see a young girl set herself on fire, but this is probably a very natural outcome of the old sects when the disciples believe in the leaders that they're gonna save them, or that kind of situation they end up. It is sad, but unfortunately these groups are almost their setup as a leader and president is similar to Islamic Republic itself.
Right, so what kind of other groups, when you say political groups, are the main ones within Iran?
There aren't any opposition group as such. The only within the Iranian government, there is a reformist. There are reformists and conservatives. Reformists have been part of the government all the time since the revolution, and they are the only legal opposition to Iranian government. Even though most of them recently been arrested, they've been part of the Iranian Islamic Republic right from the beginning, but somehow now they pushed in to be on the opposition side. But with regard to other groups, basically they are illegal and they cannot have that kind of activities, political activities.
Are there still groups though that are politically active, even though that's obviously legal and so on, to your knowledge?
No, as far as I know. Obviously if there is underground, I'm not aware of it, but not from what I read or what I see.
Right, great. And another issue that's recently been to the forefront, and also because Iran obviously is really close, is on the borders with Iraq, and the whole global war kind of story and so on and so forth. And I was just reading that recently UN inspectors are going to be going in to Iran to check for nuclear power stations and so on, because I think Iran is on a program to get nuclear power. Is that correct?
Yes. Before anything, the nuclear project in Iran started in the 70s, prior to the Iranian Revolution, during the Shah. Then Germany was the provider of this technology in Iran. It's ironic that they never asked the question why Iran, with the second or largest oil reserve, needed a different source of the energy. But then again, it was West who was promoting it. Now it's Russia. The question now, I do not know how far they've gone, but Iranian official stand is they are for peace and basically for the energy rather than the developing the atomic bomb. I'm not sure what exactly are behind this, but nonetheless it seems now even Europe is putting pressure on Iran to be more transparent with regard to their program. It's the sign is Iranian probably are going to sign to the nuclear atomic energies convention, so inspectors are free to go anytime and inspect it. It seems they've put a condition: if the sanction is lifted against Iran, they wouldn't have any problem to sign in it. This is part of the perhaps bargaining with West.
And I don't know, do you think this might be used as an excuse that Iran is, by the US, that Iran is constructing weapons of mass destruction or something like that, and that Iran might be the next on the US hit list in the area? I mean, also when one considers that Iran has immense oil resources and so on, I don't know. How do you feel about that?
If the Americans' project in Iraq had gone well, in a sense, whatever their plan was, it seems somehow it didn't work, or at least it didn't work the way they expected. if it had gone pretty well, then probably Iran would have been the next target. But the situation is pretty messy in Iraq, and Americans got a lot in their hands to sort that one out first. It doesn't look like there is an immediate threat in, you know, military action against Iran. However, having said that, it is if things goes really bad, and American or they might adopt a different policy of escalating the situation, they may do some sort of activities. But I think probably if they are going to undermine the Iranian government, it's going to be by opposition groups or other countries rather than themselves directly involving with the conflict. It is probable, but it is possible, not probable. I don't see at the moment a very reasonable option for American administration, I don't think. And plus the fact there are two approach in Bush's administration with regard to how to deal with Iran.
Right, and I don't know, what do you see in the future for Iran? I know in the 70s there was the revolution, which was student movements, right, if I'm correct, yeah, which wanted to change. Do you see maybe something like that happening again in Iran at some point soon?
Maybe, but I think the war situation is changed. This is particularly Cold War is over. Now these anti-imperialist democratic revolution basically do not see any prospect, and most of them have failed, or in fact I should say all of them have failed. So if anything is going to reasonably happen to improve people's livelihood or the quality of their life, I cannot see any particular country can do on its own. It is we are like, you know, the everyday wars. Globalization probably is going to require global resistance rather than the Iranian people, and situation is probably right for that kind of movement rather than any nationalistic movement.
Lovely, thank you very much. Thank you for coming down.
Cheers.
That was great. And there was Ali talking about the Iranian situation, and now we're going to move on with some pre-recorded stuff that we have of Anarcho Babe in Scotland. Thank you, Anarcho Babe, for that. And it's an interview with Simon at an anti-repression action in Edinburgh, the 7th of 2003. Simon was arrested for wearing a t-shirt saying, Bush, can't say the first bit because I'm live on radio. And yeah, it was an anti-war demonstration. You can check out more stuff on indymedia.org.uk, more information on that. And this is an audio interview. The court cases are coming up and are now relating to anti-war events. So this is, yeah, a short interview with Simon, charged with incitement to racial hatred because of what he was carrying. Was that the T-shirt, Bill, actually? Was that the flag? I see here the flag, but I thought...
placard, something like that, maybe a flag.
With a Bush on it.
Bush.
Right.
A fine... Anglo-Saxon word in the truest Chaucerian tradition of the English language. I think you get my meaning. Okay,
enough is said. Let's hear Simon then.
I'm Simon, the boy who got arrested.
Why are you standing in front of a police station today?
Well, for legal reasons, all I can actually tell you is that I'm here in a professional capacity as the station manager of Dilated Radio. We've been here with Mike Boone of The Boone Show, covering this as a public interest case. Obviously, it's a condition of my bail that I can't actually attend any illegal demonstrations, so I'm not actually at the demonstration.
You're not here, but what is it all about then?
It's basically about I was arrested for waving an upside-down American flag with Fuck Bush written on it. I was charged with racial hatred. Basically, I've been charged as a racist. which is obviously quite a touchy point for myself.
There were lots of other cases. What is the proceedings with the other case and of the anti-war demo, and what is the proceeding with your case?
I know that these laws have been used in the past to stitch up anti-racist protesters. It's more government tools for sort of controlling people when they're moving en masse. So they can roll these things out, you don't have to do anything, and they can use it to shut down any demonstration they want. This is now a freedom of speech issue, and I think that's basically what this has become. That's why Mark's here today, and that's why I'm here.
They want to proceed with your case or not?
They do want to proceed. I've got an intermediary diet tomorrow, which is where we're going to have debate about the actual legality of the charges, because they may not actually be legal under Scottish law. Depending on that, my trial's set for the 25th of this month, but it may be postponed again tomorrow.
Do you want people to come along?
Yeah, anyone to come along that can do. Mark said he was going to try and get come up. He's been sort of telling everybody to come down. So the more people that come along, the better, because we do need just to turn around and show these people that we don't care what they do. When we disagree with them, we will say that we disagree with them.
Hello, welcome back. We've now got Kathleen Halliday, who's a... campaigning for something called Holistic Fraternity. Sorry about that. Do you want to tell me a little bit about what it is?
Well, the domain is called Holistic Fraternity. It's a website that's dedicated to the preservation of a piece of ancient woodland in the Rotherham area. And this ancient woodland contains a henge. And the henge dates back to the late Neolithic, or maybe it could be the early Iron Age. But the wood is actually threatened by environmental development.
This woodland is called... What's it called?
The woodland is called Scold's Coppice. The actual henge is a registered ancient monument. Its name is Caesar's Camp. It was dated by the University of Sheffield to the late Neolithic or early Iron Age.
Wow, so this is a highly traditional, prehistoric woodland we're talking about. What exactly are you campaigning against or for?
Well, ancient woodland in this country is disappearing very fast. If you look on the Greenpeace site, they are quite concerned about the way that the woodland is disappearing. In its own right, as a piece of ancient woodland, it should be protected. And what's been happening over the last... about 20 years is that Rotherham Council want a road across there to join up to Thorpe Hesley and Scholes. They've applied for permission before and been refused. And so what they've actually done is they took over management of the wood. Ancient woodland does not need management. It's always been there, and it does not need any management to survive. It needs leaving alone. And what they did is they put roads in for lorries. They went in and chopped the trees down, they shot the squirrels. The piece of meadowland above there, it was used to be called Admiral's Field, it's where Keppel's Column is. It was a wild meadow since the 50s when it was cleared. It used to be woodland. The meadow had butterflies, wild orchids. There were jays, there were skylarks nesting in the grass, and all that's gone because they mow it. In addition to that, there were, when they originally cleared the woodland in the 50s, they put in culverts. A culvert is a concrete channel that is sunk into the ground, and because the trees weren't there to take the water away, they put the culverts in to take the water away from the wood. And the water from them went down a channel into a stream, which drained away through some land at Thorpe Hesley. What the council have actually done, what their conservationists have done, is fill in the culverts with gravel. There's now bulrushes growing out of some of them. The water does not go into the stream, which has dried up the land at Thorpe Hesley, which incidentally they wanted to build 1,100 houses on recently. But the water now drains straight down into the wood. There's photographic evidence on my website to show this. And the water drains straight over the ancient monument, which is at least 3,000 years old. And it's washing it away.
So this environmental management or mismanagement is potentially making a worse of a problem than conserving it.
Well, it's actually making it so that they would have a piece of dry land to put a road on if they wanted to.
And so how successful have your campaigns and actions been in preventing the development?
Well, Rescue, who are the British Archaeological Trust, they took an interest a few years ago, and I was told that there was an order put on the wood that stopped any more felling of the mature trees, because without the mature trees the water becomes really high, the water table, and then the smaller trees can't survive. So they put an order on to stop the felling, and they ordered them not to put any more roads into the wood. And there is a group of local people who are quite concerned. They've been going in and removing rubbish and keeping an eye on the place.
Oh, it sounds like your efforts are paying off. So how exactly could other people around the area help out and try and prevent this chaos going?
Well, the main thing would be to lobby the Rotherham Council. It's Rotherham Metropolitan Borough Council. It's their conservationists who are responsible for the place. If they want to protect this site, ancient woodland, and the henge that lies within it, then they need to remove the gravel that's in those culverts, and they need to restore the drainage from the field so they can get it going where it was before, down into the stream, because otherwise the earthwork will be washed away, which is a terrible shame when it stood there untouched for thousands of years. And if the gravel was taken out of the culverts, they could be covered over so that people could still walk on the top of there. But then the water would go away from the wood rather than running down into it. So it's lobbying, really. Letter writing, ring them up. Just make them know your views. Let them know that you want to protect this place.
Oh, well, thanks for coming in, Kath. And hope all your work and action to protect this ancient woodland, and hope that our natural environment gets to thrive after from your work. Okay, now back to Bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, everybody in the studio. Thanks for coming down. Very interesting stuff there about protecting valuable wildlife and woodland activities. Right, here I've got an interview recorded by an Arco Babe with Mark Thomas at the Edinburgh Anti-Repression Action on the 17th of July. I'll just read this out here while trying to do something else unrelated to my next task. On the 17th of July, an anti-repression action took place at St Leonard's Police Station in solidarity with Simon, a protester who got arrested and charged with incitement for racial hatred because of the modifications of the American flag that he was carrying. We had an interview with him earlier. So this is an interview with Mark Thomas, recorded back at the Bongo Club, who called together support and campaigns for Simon. Try and spot the swearing. I've tried to do the best job I can to edit it out. So let's hope that this works.
Why are you here today?
Well, one, because Simon emailed me shortly after his arrest and sent a JPEG of the photo for which he was arrested, for carrying the flag. And I just thought it was absolutely outrageous, just a real outrage. And it was part of a pattern of events that happened post the start of the bombing, where the police clamped down on protest and dissent. And it's part of a whole movement where people were arrested at Fairford on a coach and had to stay on a coach and were turned back from a demonstration. The right to freedom of travel and freedom of movement was just impeded by the police. It was part of a whole movement where the cops in Lancashire tried to bring in the Public Order Act, against 16, 17-year-old kids for organising a demonstration outside the town hall. There's a real pattern of the police clamping down on the anti-war movement. So what I did was, with some friends, because I was touring at the time, was get loads of the cards printed with a fush on it and with the flag upside down, and said, okay, well, these are the names of the cops who did it, and this is the police station, and you should send it in, and got people to fill in the names and to post it off to the cops, and quite a few got through to them. Well, thousands. We've had thousands of them go, And our basic thing that we've always said is, if Simon's guilty, then we're guilty. It's just a nonsense. You know, the idea that a named individual, the president, on a flag flying upside down, you know, is actually therefore representative of a race is absolute nonsense. It's a representative of a political ideology and a ruling class. And that's what it's representative of. It's not about, you know, Americans, who incidentally are not a race but a nation. You know, if Americans are a race, I want to know their racial characteristics. There aren't any, because they're made up of immigrants. That's the whole thing of America. America's quite proud that it's made up of immigrants. You know, that's the gig of it. Secondly, it means that power's got no part in the equation of racism. So therefore you can't criticise the most powerful people. That racism is just about people being a little bit bigoted towards each other, and really if we sit down on cushions and hold hands, we'll be fine. Well, that's not the gig. Racism is about power. It's about power to inflict your views, your power, your control over people because of their race. That's what it's about. And if you therefore say that you can't criticise the most powerful people, the most racist nation, by its actions as a foreign power, you know, as its imperial power, you know, its actions towards other countries, then that's an absolute nonsense. It's an absolute nonsense. And it's the cops trying it on. So, because Simon's trial's coming up, and because really we kind of thought, no, we've had enough of this kind of crap. We kind of decided to come up and try and hand ourselves in, and got in contact with people at the Bongo Club and various friends and what have you, and we had 60 people turn out, a really nice little event. And I think the cops have... hopefully the press, you know, the mainstream press will cover it in such a way that it will create embarrassment for the prosecution, though I think they're possibly beyond embarrassment, and the mainstream press is inevitably the mainstream press.
Did you ever have problems with your comedy show, that people thought you were going too far and then tried to silence you or stop you with anything?
Yeah, people have tried to censor the show, and sometimes they've been successful in it. Generally the way that they try and censor a show like that is not through trying to cut bits out, but by underfunding it, or lack of support for ideas, or controlling your editorial freedom, rather than going, ah, you have found this, we shall cut this out. It's much more insidious in the way that censorship works.
What was your involvement with the anti-war activities?
I did loads of stuff.
I did lots. I did my bit.
I suppose the most high-profile thing that I was involved in was the attempt to, by C&D and others, to bring the government to court over the use of Resolution 1441 as a trigger mechanism to war, and try and get them into court on that. You know, there's also kind of like direct action stuff that myself and friends are involved in, as well as the demos, and as well as, you know, meetings and organising and what have you. The way forward on all of this stuff is through direct action. You know, there are two reasons for this. One is because actually it works. Actually, the power of civil disobedience absolutely works, and it's actually about people saying, off this, you know, off your stupidity, off you. I'm withdrawing my consent. I withdraw my consent from this. I'm taking it away, and you're not going to have my voice in it. I'm no longer support you, and I'm opposed. I'm in opposition to the state. It's not just my right, it's my duty to do this. I think that's really absolutely important, and it's fundamental to the way things people get things changed. I mean, you get all these politicians waffling about direct action and people getting in roads and how terrible it is. Fuck off them, they're in power in politicians because direct action got them fucking vote for working people. What the fuck are they talking about? You know, and I think that actually they've forgotten all of that, and they've forgotten the fact that that actually liberties and freedoms aren't just about bits of paper, and they're not just about laws, and they're not just about what we have and we don't have. It's about what you feel inside when you're running around just doing something that's morally fucking right and saying, I'm in opposition to state. Fuck them.
Do you want to say something about how important alternative media such as Undercurrents and Indie Media are for you?
I think Indie Media is absolutely, absolutely fucking game on. Indie Media is fantastic.
Love what they do. Big fan of their work.
Big fan of their work. Followed them for years. And got all their albums. But the thing is, what I like about it is grassroots, isn't it? You know what I mean? And that's a great thing, actually. People going, this is our news. This is what we find important. This is our reports. These are our friends. This is our community. And actually go, f*** you, to the mainstream. And that's a really lovely, lovely thing to do.
And, of course, we agree with Mark Thomas, and the media is amazing. And I'd like to give a shout-out now to Cheb and Anarcho Babe that are listening to us, and are also in the chat room. And we'd also like to say hi to Ajaz, who was on the show last week, and whose tune from the compilation Peace Not War, we're going to be playing now. So DJ, Disorientalist, Occident and Emergency.
Sundays, holidays, vacation time, we must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover. That's the first thing to do. Duck and cover. First, you duck. And then, you cover. You duck and cover. Fight. Duck and cover under the table.
दहशतगर्दी अफसाना है ये जंग तो एक बहाना है दहशतगर्दी अफसाना है
Right, that was DJ Disorientalist, also known as Ajaz, who was in the studio last week. That was a tune off the Peace Not War CD. They've got a website, which is peacenotwar.org, something like that. I've got in the studio now Chris, who is representing Sheffield's burgeoning open source and free software movement. So, Chris, tell me about free open source software. What is it, basically?
Well, what it isn't software that's just available for free. There's quite a lot of Windows software available on the internet that you can download for free, shareware and things like that. But the free software movement is actually something different. It's the term that's often used for it is the open source software movement. And there is a lot of overlap between the open source software movement and the free software movement. The free software movement is basically creating software that's anyone that gets a copy of it, they're free to modify it, to redistribute it, to sell it, to give it away. And it's usually created by people for free in their free time.
All right, interesting. Right, just like I was stuck there for what question to ask you next. So, why do people create free software? What's the point in doing so?
There's been quite a lot of work been done on kind of writing up ideas about why people think free software is created. There's a guy, Eric Raymond, that's written quite a lot of stuff that has a theory that it's a kind of gift economy, that people write free software in order to be able to give away things for free and in order to get kind of credit from their peers. Personally, I don't actually think he's right. I think people usually do it just to kind of scratch an itch. People do it because they want a bit of software to do a particular job and they can't find one that's suitable on the internet, so they just decide to write one themselves, or they're using a bit of software and there's something about it they don't like, so they decide to fix the thing they don't like. And with free software, there's no reason why, you know, not to submit your changes to the software back to the maintainer of the software. So that's what happens, and I think it's just people do it just to, you know, scratch an itch, as it were.
I see. So if I get a CD, borrow a CD off a friend, Microsoft, you know, operating system, and install that or download it off the internet, buy some cracked software from a computer fair, is that not free software? Is that not a revolutionary act?
That's free as in you're not paying for it. But no, I don't think that's free at all. I think Microsoft's actually quite happy that there's large quantities of their software is pirated, because it's one of the key ways in which they've been able to gain and keep their dominance of the software industry. The time you spend in learning how to install Windows and learning how to kind of maintain Windows and all of that is those skills are then ones that people go on to kind of use in order to support Windows and retain its dominance. I think I don't think that's free software at all. And
so using free software kind of builds a kind of community that can perhaps help itself then. Would you agree with that?
It's very much come about in parallel with the kind of spread of the internet, and it's in it's fundamentally kind of linked to the internet. I think it's the internet's enabled groups of people that have a similar interests all around the globe to get together, coordinate, cooperate, and, you know, produce things in a manner that's never been possible before.
I understand you went to a conference in Germany. It's called Project Equinox, or Equinox, I don't know how to pronounce it. Can you tell me more about that and what project... Well, you can pronounce it for me. Can you tell me more about that project, please?
Project Equinox. It's a couple of German words have stuck together, and that's how it's come up with that. I'm not sure exactly. I can't remember exactly the origin of the name. Their web address is equinox.org. That's EOKONUX.org, and it's been going a few years, and the ideas kind of behind that site, and most of the discussion is actually in German on their German discussion list. Their English email list is fairly quiet. But the thinking behind that is that the production method of free software is basically a new mode of production. It's a mode of production in which basically people is qualitatively different from other kind of, say, hobby things where people just do stuff for free in their own time. It's fundamentally different from something like basket weaving, because it isn't using kind of pre-industrial production methods. It's using the most advanced technology available to people. It's based on international cooperation. It's producing world-class software that is a very real threat at the moment to the world's richest corporation, Microsoft. And it's all being produced basically by people who are just doing it for fun because they want to do it. There are numbers of people these days employed to write free software, but I think still fundamentally it's the nature of it is that it's people doing stuff because they want to do it just for the fun of it. And this is producing world-class quality and generally useful product that can be used, you know, for almost anything.
All right, interesting point. Can you tell us about some of the, as you say, world-class open source or free software products that are actually in common use? I mean, the one that springs to mind is the Apache web server, but I'm sure you've got some other examples you can give us.
Yeah, I mean, Apache's often cited as the kind of the killer application of Linux or Linux. 63% odd of websites are served with Apache. Other very popular bits of software are Mozilla, which is from the Netscape project, which is a free web browser that's a lot more standards compliant than Internet Explorer, has a lot of nice nifty features, can run on any platform. Other kind of software that is kind of virtually a drop-in replacement for the Windows alternative is things like OpenOffice, which has got a word processor, spreadsheets, so on and so forth. One of the most popular pieces of software on SourceForge, which is a kind of website where people can kind of get together to create their own free software, is GAIM, G-A-I-M, and that's at game.sf.net, and that's does instant messaging, and it supports Microsoft Instant Messaging, Yahoo, AOL,
all of them,
all the different protocols, and is free. And it doesn't have another thing. I mean, I haven't used Windows for a long time now, but every time I see a Windows computer, and just using one out there now, there's adverts popping up everywhere all the time and things like this, and spyware and all sorts of rubbish. Well, you just don't have these things with free software, because if anyone proposes to put anything like that into the software, the people maintaining the software just, you know, will just laugh at them and say no, and it just isn't there because people don't like that stuff.
Sounds good to me. It took me a good half an hour to clean my PC of spyware after I went away on holiday. Never mind about that. So, just going back to more of the philosophy and politics of it all. In Sheffield, we saw a film on Saturday. A few of us, 49 of us in actual fact, watched Revolution OS, and a spokesman for the free software movement, or the open source software movement in particular, we'll perhaps talk about that distinction in a bit. He said that he had been accused of, been accused that Linux was communism. Can you tell me something about that? Is it communism, by other words?
I think in many ways it can be argued that it represents a a form of kind of post capitalist mode of production taking roots within capitalism. However, I'm in a minority within the kind of free software movement with these views. The majority of people especially in the US, are actually people like Eric Raymond would probably describe himself as a kind of libertarian capitalist. A lot of people in the free software movement are actually argue in favour of capitalism. They might argue against software patents and copyright of software and restrictions like that they see as preventing a more free-for-all capitalism. But no, I mean, a large number of people writing and using free software wouldn't consider themselves anti-capitalist at all. They'd actually consider themselves quite pro-capitalist. However, I still think that the actual inherent nature of free software has an anti-capitalist dynamic.
Oh, right. Anyway, very good. Well done, Chris, for
ad-libbing there while we were trying to get a call put through to the studio, but I don't know what's happened to the call. Can we have the call back to the studio, perhaps? Because me and Chris are going to we're going to finish off soon. Chris, can you tell me more about what's happening for anybody who's interested in getting into Linux in the Sheffield area and beyond? I understand there's a few things coming up.
I think there's some stuff being run at Access Space by Low Tech. I haven't actually got the dates in front of me.
And their website is?
It's
lowtech.org.
Yeah, that's it. LOWTCH.org. And they've got some, I think they've got a kind of Linux 2-day workshop on installing software coming up in a few weeks and a number of other things. There's also this event coming up in Lancaster, the Activists weekend workshop for anti-capitalist and progressive activists to kind of get together and, you know, find out what this free software is about. And you can get more information about that at www.seedsforchange.org.uk active.html. That's aktiv.html.
Okay, we're just trying to get a call put through to the studio for the next. If somebody could pick that up, that would help me a great deal. The phone's just gone on the floor. Okay, well, thanks, Chris, for coming in. We've lost Chris now, so I'm just going to kind of ad-lib. But we've got Sophie on the phone talking about free parties. We're going from free software to free parties. But is Sophie there?
Hello. How are you doing?
Fine. We're just about keeping it together.
I've heard.
Yeah, and, well, Steve is going to talk to you now, so
cool.
Over to you, Steve, and I'll have a breather. Cheers.
Hi, Sophie. How's it
hi,
going?
Hi, Steve. Yeah, good. Cheers. How are you?
Not too bad. Yeah, I hear you're pretty tired, yeah? You couldn't make it into the studio, so you're
I know. Well,
in.
The rain was kind of putting me off as well.
So not too many free parties, then.
Oh, well, that as well. Definitely too many.
Oh, dear. Okay. I know how that feels. Well, yeah, I was just going to chat a little bit about free parties. It's quite interesting. We've just been talking about open source software and how people are kind of getting together and making their own computer programs and they're giving them away for free. Mm. And in a way, there's a sort of a link with that with free parties. It's the same sort of thing. You've got a bunch of people who are getting together, putting quite a lot of work into making parties happen, often in the outdoors, sometimes in squats, wherever. So, yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about that. What you're sort of involved in a group that puts on free parties. What made you get involved in that?
Well, about 6 years ago, a friend of mine, Lindsay, we just decided to organise a birthday party for this guy that we'd met, and it ended up turning into a mini festival, and we just started going from there. It turned out to be a wicked success, and we just thought, hey, let's carry this on. It's a pretty male-dominated society, so we thought, well, we'll try and work it out for the girls, and it's been really great. We met Rachel and Christina, and together we all own a sound system together, and we rock Sheffield. It's really good.
Okay, and so you've carried on going from that sort of first free party then. What is it about free parties that you think makes them preferable to elsewhere? I mean, there's clubs, there's all over the sort of Sheffield city, we've got clubs everywhere.
Yeah.
What makes free parties better?
Well, I think going to a night out in a club is very constricting. There's lots of rules and regulations. People go to them to try and make almost a statement there. They're all dressed up to the nines, showing themselves off. Whereas at free parties, there's no qualms about anyone, race, colour, creed, anything. It's just all free and easy, and you can just go along and do whatever you like and have as much fun as you like. Go exploring, climb trees, make dens, or have a dance.
Right, and have you had much sort of trouble? Because obviously with the Criminal Justice Bill and various other laws that keep getting brought in all the time, have you had any problems from the police at all doing this kind of thing?
Yeah, we've had a few parties where they've come along and they've switched us off and shut us down. We did one a couple of months back, which has actually been publicised on indie media. The police had Section 63'd the land, which meant that any goings on with more than two people on the land, then all equipment would be seized and people would be arrested. That was quite a serious one. And they followed us all around the county, well, several counties, trying to stop our parties. But we managed to get it together at the end. But they do they do put quite a few constrictions on things, but and again, at other times they've been really wicked and they've just come along and said, oh, can you turn it down?
Right, so the party that you put on a couple of months ago, that managed to get going eventually, is that right?
Yeah, about 4 o'clock in the morning it got started, but after 4 different locations have been moved on.
Okay, and do you think there's any kind of sort of politics or ideology behind the free party scene that you see?
I knew you were going to ask a question like this. Yeah, no, I think free parties are just they're just there to be appreciated for their own rights. There's no oh God, what's the word? You've caught me.
Oh dear.
My brain has gone blank. They're just there to be enjoyed for their own thing. I've just said that, haven't I?
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of, well, like, we just had the open source thing, and there's obviously a bit of sort of politics behind that in undermining Microsoft and the whole sort of DIY, do-it-yourself culture.
Yeah. It's just I don't know, it's just amazing. The free parties are just the most easy thing for anyone to enjoy, and they like anything for free, it should be enjoyed for its full potential.
Right, and just so talking about the term free, that obviously costs you quite a lot. You know, your group's got its own sound system. Then you've got the sort of transport to get it there. It's quite a lot of work involved, putting up structures, whatever needs to be done. Do you get much? I mean, how do you fund that? And
it takes quite a lot of money to run a free party, but the whole way I think about it is, well, we're putting this money in. If we get it back, then we get it back. If we don't, it doesn't matter. Everyone's had a really wicked time. It's at the end of the day, it's only money. It's just a couple of quid here and there, but yeah, they do cost a bit, and you've got to get donations, and usually people are quite generous with them, and they give you loads.
Okay, so you're not sort of out of pocket generally then?
Yeah, all the time, but
oh, yeah.
I don't know, I don't care myself.
Okay, that's good. So, finish off then. How do people, there's been quite a few free parties this year in Sheffield already.
Yeah.
How do people find out about them if they want to get involved or do stuff?
There usually ends up being some flyers floating around with a phone number on, and you've got to ring the number and find out the directions on that night. But word of mouth is the best way, and the nicest way, I think, to get people chatting, making friends and coming to the parties and all meeting up and having a wicked time.
Okay, that's great. Thanks very much, Sophie.
Thank you very much.
Okay, now I've
been to the rest of your show.
Well, let's not go into that. Okay.
See you later.
Bye.
Cheers, bye.
And just about free parties, there are some politics involved. The freedom to get together and enjoy without rules, regulations, bouncers, and having to pay through the nose, basically. And obviously the government doesn't like that, and that's why they've cracked down on it quite a few times. So it's the right to freely appreciate our space that's around us. And it doesn't seem like authorities like that sometimes, but anyway, hey. I think we're going to go to some newswire stuff now, if I'm correct, yeah? no one knows, I'm taking over, that's fine. So I've got here some news concerning a lawsuit against Prime Minister Tony Blair. So the Athens Bar Association, Athens, Greece, that is, has decided to lodge a complaint with the International Criminal Court against Prime Minister Tony Blair's government for alleged crimes against humanity in Iraq. The 20,000 member bar association says that the US and British military forces in Iraq breached international treaties such as the UN Charter, the Geneva Conventions, and the statutes of the International Criminal Court. The action also cites Jack Straw, the British Foreign Secretary, Jeff Hoon, the Secretary of Defence, and Adam Ingram, the Minister of State for the Armed Forces. America is excluded from this as it didn't ratify the International Criminal Court that was set up only about a year ago, so they're excluded from it. If it is decided that there are crimes against humanity and war crimes, Blair will have to come in front of a jury and a judge, which it's a bit doubtful, but hey, you never know. And if the case is heard, the Bar Association said it would summon a number of high-level personalities as witnesses, including UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, former UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix, the President of the European Commission, Romano Prodi, and the EU's Foreign and Security Police Chief, Javier Solana. So, I think that's definitely a case to be heard there. So we'll see how that goes. Apart from that, some news from Chiapas and from the Zapatistas movement. The Zapatistas have been relatively quiet for a few years now, but are picking up again steam as Fox's administration is doing very, very little to solve any problems or to help alleviate the poverty and the severe social issues that peasants have to face in Mexico. So, apparently, the Zapatistas have issued a communique recently, a few days ago, and they say that it would be good if national and international civil society does not make any appointments for the days of August 8th, 9th and 10th. We don't know why. Well, I think they do, but they don't want to say anything. So that's in a couple of weeks, and it'll be quite interesting to see what's happening there. And Marcos also mentioned that the Zapatistas will shortly begin to broadcast a shortwave radio signal around the world, including a late-night program by Marcos himself. We'll be looking forward to hearing that as well. I don't know what else is on the agenda right now, but I think, it's another tune.
Horace Andy,
reggae, rebellious reggae. So... good vibes, here we go.
This is
Sheffield Indie Media
on Sheffield Live 106.6 FM on the web at sheffield.indiemedia.org.uk.
Right, and yes, you are listening to Sheffield Indie Media on Sheffield Live 106.6, and this is our last show on air, unfortunately. We will be coming back once a month with a two-hour show, and we're very sad to see it end, but we've had a really good time, and we've really enjoyed doing this. But we've still got about another 10-12 minutes, so we're going to hear an interview with Jam 74 anti-road protester, and against a six-lane elevated motorway that the Scottish Executive plans to build in the southern suburbs of Glasgow. So, yeah, I think I won't go on about it too much. I'll just let the interview roll.
Martha, you are here with the M74 campaign. What exactly is the name of the campaign?
It's a joint action against the M74 extension, which is proposed to start in the autumn of 2004. It'll mean a 5-mile motorway coming right through Cambuslang, Rutherglen, Torryglen, Govanhill, right into the heart of Glasgow, bringing more pollution, more environmental problems, more health risks, and bulldozing through local communities on the south side, taking away homes and businesses and destroying communities' way of life.
What do you want to do against it? What are your methods to try to oppose it?
On economic grounds, we want there to be a public local inquiry because it's going to cost £500 million. This is without proper research and an independent alternative being proposed or looked at, because this money could also be used to enhance the other types of transport provision. Rail infrastructure, public transport, walking and cycling could be considered. We'd like to see a cross Glasgow Crossrail network and emphasis put on moving freight using the trains rather than the roads. And this is more sustainable and is better for the future of Glasgow that this can be brought on board. The railways are the future. The problems with the supply of oil are well known because of people know through the Iraq war that the oil is a treasured possession by the West. And we, you know, they're building a motorway relying on cars and petrol as a way of supporting the economy. But we know that that's not going to last in the long run. We have to look at renewable energy and protect the environment for our future generations. Building a motorway won't do that. It'll destroy the communities in the south side. It will enhance problems, health problems of Glasgow through pollution. They're also going to be having to remove toxic waste to actually build this motorway. There's chromium waste at Cambuslang that would be disturbed. It could go into the water supply, into the air, and it's a toxic poison. It could kill someone.
What are you planning to do against it?
So, yeah, we're asking for people to write a letter to the new Transport Minister, Nicol Stephen. We have regular meetings in the Govanhill Neighbourhood Centre that people can join, and we are having stalls at various events over the summer to raise awareness of the impact the motorway will have on the communities in the south side, but across Glasgow, and try to stop it just through regular discussion with local people, letting people know that, you know, they have a say, they can write a letter, they can speak to their local elected representatives and take part in groups to meet and put forward alternatives.
So Govanhill was like very famous of a Govanhill swimming pool campaign, lots of direct action squatting the swimming pool. Is this again a campaign which is rooted like in the local community, but it is also kind of having activism as in direct action against the motorway?
We have all sorts of opportunities. We have to consider every way forward to try to stop it, and it'll be up to each individual what they feel able to do. But at this stage, we would like people to write a letter to the local politicians, their councillors, their MSPs, their MPs, and the Minister for Transport at the Scottish Parliament, Nicol Stephen, obviously direct action has been taken before in these cases to try to stop motorways, but you know, everyone has different points of view about what they should, what they're willing to do, and at this stage we're looking for support and for people to write letters.
So when is decision time on this motorway? Is it already decided or is it still in the run-up?
Decision time was autumn 2004.
Okay.
The road would be open in 2008 if it was given the go-ahead.
If people are interested to join your campaign and to know more about it, how can they kind of contact you?
There is the JAM 74 have a website, but you can write to us at PO Box 3751, Glasgow G42 8WR.
Okay, and now we've got a few UK newswire stories for you. On Sunday the 20th of July, it's a bit dated now, in the City Hall in Cardiff, a life-size statue was unveiled to commemorate the women's who fought for Greenham Commons. It's going to be a timeless tribute. It was a mother holding a baby draped in muslin with suffragette coloured ribbons, and there was a big bash on to unveil that. Okay, next we've got following the violence on Friday in Hull, there was a big gathering of refugees and people to support the immigrants there who've been brutally racially abused and the violence that was caused. And apparently since then some representatives from the refugee and the police have been meeting to discuss how to try and tackle this issue. So we've got some positive outcome from some action there. Oxford Street on Saturday, the 2nd of August, there's going to be a Boycott Israeli Goods Day of Action. It's going to be against all the main corporate sponsors of the brutality and the illegal occupation of Palestine. And they'll be going around Oxford Street, probably demonstrating against some of the big names around there. A bit of a follow-up from one I mentioned last week. The boycott of Coca-Cola, there was a global day of action. We've had a report back from Melbourne, Australia, that 150 people were rallying there. Down in London, there were six protesters locked themselves to gates and trucks and managed to stop the Coca-Cola plant from producing for a good time. And apparently, this made Coca-Cola lose $30,000 in revenue from that, so that's a good bit of direct action putting the corporates to shame. There was 10 arrests there, but they've all been released without charge. So that's some more good action from the week.
And there's some more actions and events coming up next weekend, 1st to the 3rd of August in Bradford. There's the Radical Film and Book Festival, 3 days of films, books to buy, discussions on direct action, on social centres and so on. I think sounds very interesting. I'm definitely going to go down there. And also something, a really big action that's being planned for September. Don't book anything for the 6th or the 12th because it's all happening down in London. There's the big Disarm Dicey conference demos and so on happening for a week. Disarm Dicey is a campaign to shut down the defence systems and equipment to National Arms Fair in London's Docklands, which is going to be happening as well from the 9th to the 12th of September. And it's and Dicey is actually one of the world's biggest ever trade fairs for guns, bombs, military planes, small arms, mines and tanks. So the plan is to shut down Dicey. And there's nearly a week of activities planned, with Saturday the 6th of September, Unity March in central London, ending with speakers. Sunday the 7th, the first day of the Disarm Dicey conference, with workshops. Monday 8th, day 2 of the conference, and a multi-faith vigil outside the XL Centre, where the Dicey Arms Fair is taking place. Tuesday 9th, facing the arms traders, peaceful demo at Custom House. Wednesday 10th, day of direct action blockades. And Thursday 11th of September, significant day, a peaceful vigil, and Friday an open forum to discuss what's happened in the week and how to do things in future. So there's going to be accommodation provided for, and so on and so forth, and it's an international demonstration as well. Mark Thomas is plugging it. Well done, Mark Thomas. And apparently Yabasta are already confirmed for coming, and hopefully there'll be people from all over Europe and possibly the world. So see you there, hopefully. And that's nearly the end of our show, right, Bill? We're going to like do a few shout-outs.
That's right, yeah. Well, thanks to everyone who's been listening on FM and on the internet. Shout going out to Cheb, otherwise known as Alan, and also Anarcho Babe in the chat room. And then maybe there's some other people listening on the internet. Maybe Philippe in Montreal as well. A shout going out to Paul T and Dan and everybody else who's been involved in Sheffield Indie Media Radio. Anyone else you want to say hello to? Or?
Yes, I'd like to say thank you to all our guests that these 4 weeks came and informed us on loads of topics. And there's a real bunch of very interesting people here in Sheffield, which I will be very proud of what everyone's getting up to and stuff. And that's about it.
Okay, we're finishing off with a tune now, aren't
with
we?
A Palestinian hip-hop group, and the song is called Intifada, which means struggle, by the way.
Okay, well, good night to everyone out there.
Until the next time.
Until the next time, next year, or whatever.